On April 15, 2013, two homemade bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three people and wounding more than 264 others. In the ensuing manhunt, Tamerlan Tsarnaev died, and his younger brother, Dzhokhar, was captured and ultimately charged on 30 federal counts. Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen tells the story in the new book, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy, in which she looks to explain who the brothers were, where they came from, what shaped them, and the struggle that ensued for each of them between assimilation and alienation. It's a great pleasure to welcome Masha Gessen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What led you to want to investigate the story, a story that really takes you around the world?
That's actually one of the biggest reasons I wanted to do it. It seemed like a story made for me. I've covered both of the wars in Chechnya, and I've been in and out of there for basically the last 20 years. I have worked in Russia. I have studied terrorism, and I've covered a lot of the terrorist attacks in Russia perpetrated by people from Chechnya. And I was a teenage Russian-speaking immigrant in the Boston area, so it seemed almost perfect. You know, it seemed in some ways a story that I could only I could tell, or rather there were stories there that only I could tell.
So give us a sense of what your starting point was in the knowledge, obviously, of the tragedy itself, but your knowledge of these two men and then the questions that you wanted to answer at the very beginning.
Well, in terms of these two men, I think that I started out more or less like everybody else. There was certainly a deluge of information, most of it accurate, that emerged in the first few days after they were identified. So we heard a lot about, you know, from their school friends. We heard that they lived in Cambridge. We heard something about their landlady. We had sort of the general outline of their lives. What I think I brought to the story at that point was an understanding of how the Russian-speaking community in Boston exists. And they were sort of a part of it. I mean, the Chechens, there are only half a dozen Chechen families in the Boston area. They are a little separate and apart, but they still interact with the Russian-speaking community. They do business with the Russian-speaking community. They go to Russian restaurants, et cetera. So I had the lay of the land in that sense. And I think the other thing that I brought to the story was that I knew from the beginning, and obviously many other reporters knew very soon, that the background story was very important to this, not just the war in Chechnya, but the decades that preceded the war in Chechnya, the mass deportation of Chechens during World War II that has really shaped the self-understanding of the Chechen people.
With that said, what brought Tamerlan and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev to Boston?
Well, Boston was actually the last stop in a very long, zigzagging journey that their parents took in search of a home. His father was born in exile in Kyrgyzstan and Central Asia, where Chechens were deported in 1944. His mother was born in Dagestan, which, even though it sounds a lot like Kyrgyzstan, is actually 1,500 miles away. It's in the North Caucasus. And she is not Chechen. She is Avar, which is a closely related ethnicity. In the eyes of the Russians, it's indistinguishable from Chechens. But it's actually a separate ethnicity with a very different history. And this meant that they were never really accepted as a couple by the Chechen clan back home in Kyrgyzstan. So when they first got married, they met in Siberia. They first got married. They moved to Kyrgyzstan. They very quickly left and went to Kalmykia, a republic on the Caspian, where Tamerlan was born. Then they went back to Kyrgyzstan. Then with three children, they had had two more girls, they moved to Chechnya, and then the war in Chechnya started. They moved back to Kyrgyzstan after having had Dzhokhar, the youngest child, in Chechnya. Then they moved from Chechnya to Dagestan, from Kyrgyzstan to Dagestan, and that was terrible timing as well. They got there just as the war in Chechnya had spread to Dagestan, which has really been sort of the focal point of armed conflict in the last dozen years. And then from there, they went to the United States. So you can see that these people, this is just an endless history of dislocation.
The brothers were how old when they arrived in this country?
Jawahar was 8 years old. Tamerlan, the older brother, didn't come right away. The three older children were actually left in Central Asia for about a year and a half while the parents applied for asylum. And then once they got asylum, they came over. So Tamerlan was 16 when he came over.
When do you start to see the seeds of unrest and a feeling that they want to take a violent action?
Yeah, that's a very, very tricky question. I think that there's sort of separate strands here. There's the strand of the unraveling of their American dreams and their lives in the United States. And that was gradual. It took a decade. But basically, by about 2009, it was clear that that America hadn't worked out either for a variety of reasons. You know, the father never, Tamerlan and Jawahar's father, never learned English. The mother did actually very well. She learned English. She got her beautician certificate. She got a good job. And then 2008, the financial crisis, the beauty salon where she worked closed. So she lost work. She worked as a home health aide. The daughters were married off to young Chechen men in arranged marriages, but sort of softcore arranged marriages. But neither marriage worked out, so they had small children. They were living at home. The oldest son, Tamerlan, got into a community college, dropped out of community college, was delivering pizzas, was running drugs for the local dealers. So things were not working out. The sort of the American dream, what they imagined, Tamerlan becoming an Olympic boxing champion, all of that had been within reach briefly and then escaped. So I think that's sort of one strand that is very important to understanding what happened. And if we look at terrorism research, there's certainly, we see that marginalized immigrants, people who feel like they don't belong, they're the biggest risk group for committing terrorist acts. And what we think of as being most important, which is radical beliefs, actually is a lesser predictor than that experience of dislocation and disenfranchisement. But neither, of course, is a perfect predictor. Not everybody who feels disenfranchised goes and builds a bomb. Not everybody who holds radical beliefs, even radical beliefs that include violence, goes and builds a bomb. So ultimately, we're still left with this logical gap. We'll never be able to explain why, out of hundreds of thousands of young men for whom things haven't worked out, who feel cheated by life and who hold radical beliefs, why of all of those men, these two went and built bombs and exploded them at the Boston Marathon.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the story that you tell in the book is the bonding between these two brothers, of not only how one person can do it, but how two siblings can work together on this. Much came out in the trial, of course, of Jawahar Sanayev, as to what role each brother had in this. But talk a little bit about the dynamics between the two brothers and how they forged this bond.
Well, they seem to have very different personalities, and the defense, especially in the next phase of the trial, when the jury determines whether Jawahar Sanayev gets the death penalty or life imprisonment, the defense will be stressing that it was Tamerlan who was the main culprit. He was the leader in this duo, that he was the one who hatched the plot and Jawahar was a follower. I think there is truth to that, to the extent that certainly, or almost certainly, the Boston Marathon bombing wouldn't have happened if Tamerlan hadn't been around. So he was the leader in that sense. But the beliefs that they followed, they were Jawahar's own. He watched all the same videos. He listened to all the same songs. As Tamerlan did, he also did all the regular teenage things. He smoked lots of pot. He was the campus pot dealer at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, where he was a sophomore at the time of the bombing. He was interested in girls. He was interested in clothes. He played video games. In fact, after the bombing, he went back to campus and played video games for the next couple of days until their pictures were on television. So we see sort of a classic older brother, younger brother relationship where the older brother is the leader, and there are many criminal duos that look like that. There's also the added the component of Chechen tradition where their older brother is responsible, and he's responsible for the safety and security of the younger siblings, for their behavior. But that also means he's dominant, and he's the controller, and he's the enforcer.
In the minds of the two brothers, was there a mission statement of what they were trying to accomplish with this act?
Well, what we know about that is what Jahar Tsarnaev wrote on the sides of the boat where he hid, the dry docked boat where he hid for about 12 hours while the police were looking for him. So this was after Tamerlan had been killed during a shootout with police, and Jahar managed to escape and hide in his boat. So for hours he was writing with pencil on the side of the boat and scratching out letters on the side of the boat. And it's sort of a standard screed. It's the United States government is at fault. If the United States weren't killing Muslims, then they wouldn't have felt compelled to take innocent lives. It's not good to kill innocent civilians, but the United States government left them no choice.
You also paint a picture, and you include several text conversations and so forth, of the group of friends that are around these two men, and how they really played a role, and obviously the courts are figuring out as to what that role is and whether it's a criminal role. But there was a bit of a network, wasn't there?
Well, that's actually the sort of two separate stories, weirdly, because it appears that someone else must have been involved, if only because we still don't know where the bombs were made, right? So the bombs weren't made at Tamerlan's Cambridge apartment. They weren't made in Jahar Tsarnaev's dorm room. We know this. The FBI has told us this much. The FBI has also said they don't know where the bombs were made. That means there is another space that belongs to someone else where the bombs were made. Was this person a willing accomplice? Was this person somebody who was aware of being an accomplice? Was this somebody who was actually active in the plot? We have no idea. The FBI hasn't identified this person or these persons. So it may be the extent of the network may be as small as one person who unwittingly provided space or as large as several other people who helped them build bombs. I mean, they built a bunch of bombs in a very short amount of time. It's theoretically possible that there was just the two of them. It doesn't seem very likely. And the FBI has told us nothing about this. On the other hand, there are four young men who are awaiting sentencing on various charges related to obstruction of justice or lying to investigators. None of them is actually accused of having been part of the plot. None of them is accused of having had any prior knowledge of the plot. All of them are accused of basically misleading investigators. So three of them were charged in connection with taking Jahar's backpack from his dorm room and disposing of it. And for that, one of them is facing up to 25 years in prison, another 17, another up to 7. None of them have been sentenced yet, partly because the prosecution is waiting for them to testify in Jahar Tsarnaev's trial. And then a fourth man didn't even do anything that serious. He is basically accused of having given conflicting statements to police and FBI investigators who interviewed him on different days. He was a friend of both brothers. He had no knowledge of the plot, but he did recognize them when they were shown on television. He voluntarily went to the police, but in subsequent interviews, he gave conflicting statements. None of those statements can seriously be interpreted as having had any impact on the investigation whatsoever.
Masha Gessen is our guest this morning. The name of the book, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. You write toward the end of the book in a chapter entitled What Will We Know, in a section entitled Aftermath, about conspiracy theories that started to take shape. In your reporting, is there any link? Is there any concern? Is there any truth or really powerful thought that to any of these conspiracy theaters?
I think powerful thought is probably my best expression so far. Here are a couple of things. One is that whenever there is a clear lack of information, a conspicuous lack of information, as in this case, we will see many, many conspiracy theories flower. So I think this is, you know, we saw this with 9/11, although I think there was a bit more information, partly thanks to this, the incredible Senate investigation into 9/11. But we're seeing this even more clearly here because, as I said, there are key questions that the FBI hasn't been able to answer. And it's not even clear that they have tried very hard to answer those questions. So many people are running around with many conspiracy theories, most of which I don't think deserve a second look. At the same time, what we know are the unanswered questions. Where were the bombs made? And the second major unanswered question is, what was the relationship between Tomer Lantarnaev and the FBI? What went wrong with that relationship, right? We know that in 2011, the FBI went out to interview Tomer Lantarnaev and other family members on at least three occasions because they had received a tip from Russian law enforcement that he was a terrorism risk. Now, Russian law enforcement tips are unreliable. The FBI would be right to be extremely skeptical, as they were. But they did go to interview him. And according to witnesses and according to filing by the defense in the case, at least during the second interview, the FBI tried to recruit Tomer Lan as an informant. So the most basic question that arises is, why was the FBI unable to identify Tomer Lan Tsarnaev once they had pictures of him the day after the bombing? Why did 3 days pass and the public's help was asked for in identifying this man who should have been on the FBI's radar, right? So at the very least, we're dealing with a case where the FBI process went hugely awry. First of all, here was somebody who had been fingered as a terrorism risk, who managed to carry out a fairly intricate plot in plain view of the FBI. And second, this is someone they should have known by face. They had interviewed him. The Joint Terrorism Task Force is not a huge organization in the Boston area, nor do they interview that many possible suspects. So that's, at the very least, something went very wrong. But what was Tomer Lan's response to the FBI's efforts to recruit him? Was he ever under the impression that he was an informant? Was the FBI ever under the impression that he was an informant? We need to know this. We need to know, what tragic thing happened in that relationship, in that process. And this is especially important because the FBI's entire mode of dealing with terrorism is working through informants, is recruiting informants in Muslim communities around the United States. And a lot of the time that results in basically manufactured terrorism prosecutions that organizations like Human Rights Watch have written very well and very convincingly about.
I want to read from a section of the book and just get your reaction to this as we start to wrap up. As for the brothers themselves, theirs remains a small story in which nothing extraordinary happens, or rather no extraordinary event is necessary to explain what happened. One had only to be born in the wrong place at the wrong time, as many people are, to never feel that one belongs, to see every opportunity, even those that seem within reach, pass one by, until the opportunity to be somebody finally, almost accidentally, presents itself. This is where the small story of the Tsarnaevs joins the large story of the war on terror. And I'm interested in where you believe that brings us as a culture and as a society of understanding this war on terror.
I think we need to face the very uncomfortable fact that the way that we have responded to terrorism, especially in the last 14 years since 9/11, is by through this rhetoric of war and by making terrorism loom even larger than is, I think, warranted by the very real threat that it presents. And what that means is that for young men who feel like they're nobodies, who feel completely disengaged, and nobody is as aware of being disengaged from society as immigrants are, joining this imagined community of jihadists, and it doesn't require formal membership, it's just a decision to join, suddenly gives them an opportunity not only to belong to something large and to belong, but to declare war on a great power. It gives them incredible strength and power. And what we see is the great power accept the declaration of war. Look at the rhetoric with which society has responded to the Boston Marathon bombing. There were people chanting USA, USA, when Jihar Tanayev was captured. In court, the prosecution often uses phrases like, we were attacked. We had been attacked. We, the United States, we, the city of Boston. These are criminals who attacked people. They committed a heinous crime. But they should not be treated like state actors. They should not be treated as though they have the power to declare war and to mobilize the entire might of the United States government against them. That gives them way too much power. And that makes, for a certain subset of people, that makes the lure of terrorism that much more appealing.
Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist who is the author of several books. Most recently, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. The new book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. It is published by Riverhead Books. Masha Gessen, I thank you so much for sharing your information and your story with us this morning.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Thank you.
Thank you for great questions.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy by Masha Gessen. It's published by Riverhead. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.